Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, March 20th, 2023. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Big bills down, big bills to go. Iowa legislature has passed significant bills, but more await, including state budget. And this is by Aaron Murphy. Out of Des Moines, state lawmakers already have debated and moved some giant pieces of legislation, both literally and figuratively, during the 2023 Iowa legislative session. With work completed on many bills that could have significant impacts on Iowans for years to come, state lawmakers now are turning their attention to a new spate of bills and the state's $8 million budget for fiscal 2024. Among the session-defining bills already in lawmakers' rearview mirrors are a new state-funded private school financial aid program, a nearly 1,600-page proposal that will reorganize the executive branch of state government, bans on gender-affirming care for Iowans under age 18 and on transgender students using school restrooms and locker rooms for the gender they identify as, caps on jury awards in medical malpractice lawsuits. The workload that remains is not necessarily any lighter. Other bills remain in progress in the Republican majority legislature that also promise to have significant impact on Iowans. Legislative leaders in the Iowa House, both Republican and Democrat, discussed many of those bills over the past few days with State House reporters. So what is next on the legislative agenda? Pipelines and eminent domain. The question remains unanswered. Will state lawmakers pass any new law that deals with carbon capture pipelines, three of which have been proposed in Iowa, and more specifically, the use process of eminent domain to allow the pipelines to move across privately owned farmland? House Republicans have been advancing legislation that would create higher thresholds for pipeline companies to meet before pipelines could be constructed in Iowa. Among the most significant provisions of House File 368 is that companies would need 90% voluntary participation from landowners before it could use eminent domain to secure the remaining land needed. I believe absolutely that eminent domain should be used only for essential government services, public use versus public benefit, Representative Stephen Holt, Republican out of Denison, said Friday during recording of this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. Holt wrote the House Republican bill and also filed a formal objection with state regulators, stating he does not believe the proposed pipelines meet current requirements for the use of eminent domain. "It's a big issue for my landowners who do not believe that the blunt force of government should be allowed to be used to take their land for what is a private economic development project, because that's what we're talking about here," he stated. Holt said he expects the bill will debate and pass his Holt said he expects the House will debate and pass his bill out of the chamber, but that he has not yet had discussions about his bill with Republican leaders in the Senate, who have been legislatively quiet on the topic this session. Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat out of Dubuque, said on the same Iowa Press episode that Democrats have concerns for the environment and property rights. She said she would support requirements even stronger than the ones in Holt's bill. University settlements, DEI. Iowa, Iowa State, and the University of Northern Iowa would be required to foot the bill for the entirety of lawsuit settlement agreements involving their athletics departments under legislation advancing in the House. Holt said he plans to support the bill once it is put up for a vote in the House. "It's the athletics department, which makes a lot of money, that would be covering this instead of taxpayers. I support it," Holt said. The bill was created after the state, per state law, was to be on the hook for half of a $4 million settlement involving the University of Iowa after 12 former Hawkeye players alleged racism in the football program and sued. Amid public backlash, the university voluntarily agreed to reimburse the state for its half of the settlement from athletics department funds. The settlement requires the U of I hire an expert to oversee the implementation of its diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. That is at odds with another House bill, which would prohibit public universities from funding positions for DEI programs. Holt said he supports the bill to bar DEI hires, House File 616. But when asked about the apparent conflict with the U of I settlement, said the bill may need an amendment. James, the Dubuque Democrat, said Democrats support DEI programs and that bills like the one to prohibiting DEI programs at universities make the state appear less welcoming to prospective residents and businesses. birth control. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has proposed legislation that would allow women to buy birth control pills, contraceptive patches, and vaginal rings from a pharmacist without having a prescription from a doctor. That proposal has advanced in both the House and Senate, but in different forms. There is at this point no certainty about its legislative future. House Speaker Pat Grassley, a Republican out of New Hartford, told reporters Thursday that House Republicans will want any provision to include safety measures like a requirement that a woman periodically meet with her physician. If over-the-counter sales become law, Iowa would join 17 other states and the District of Columbia in legalizing the dispensing of birth control without a prescription, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Property taxes. Republican lawmakers came into the season, into the session focused on addressing Iowa's property taxes. GOP leaders in both chambers have introduced proposals, but they are not close in format. So if any proposal is to make it to Reynolds' desk this session, work remains for the House and Senate to come together around a proposal. Our goal with the bill, whatever it ends up looking like from the House's perspective, is to really change the narrative around the property taxes and make sure we're providing certainty for the property taxpayer, Grassley said. In 17 years here, I think we've talked about property tax, but it's always been pieces. And I think we want to have a holistic approach. That's why our bill tries to provide relief, as well as changing the way we currently do things in Iowa to provide that certainty. Income taxes. In 2022, Republican state lawmakers and Reynolds spearheaded legislation that is gradually reducing Iowa state income tax rates over multiple years until most Iowa workers will pay the same 3.9% state income tax rate. Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican of Council Bluffs, has proposed legislation that would accelerate those reductions, drop the eventual state income tax rate to 2.55%, and provide a mechanism to eventually eliminate the tax. But Grassley said House Republicans want to see how the current reductions work before diving into further cuts. I don't think our caucus has a problem with that at the right time, Grassley said. We've seen revenues continue to grow. But as this thing phases in, we want to show Iowans that our plan works. So I think you will see a conversation on income tax continue, but I don't think from the House's perspective it's probably going to be this session. State budget. Reynolds and Senate Republicans have proposed spending roughly $8.5 billion in the state budget year that begins July 1st. That would be an increase of 3.3% over the $8.2 billion allocated for the current budget year. House Republicans have not yet released their budget target, but Grassley said he doesn't expect it to be drastically different from Reynolds and Senate Republicans' proposal. April 28 is the date legislators have set as a target to adjourn. It's when their per diem allowance ends, but sessions frequently go beyond that targeted date. We have a headline and photograph here entitled Tears of Joy for Hawkeyes, NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. It has a picture of Iowa forward Monica Cinzano becomes emotional as she waves to the crowd Sunday after playing her last game in Carver Hawkeye Arena in Iowa City. The Hawkeyes defeated the Georgia Bulldogs 74-66 to reach the Sweet 16 in the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament and will next play Friday in Seattle. All right, our next story, Pearl Harbor sailor coming home for burial. Donald A. Stott of Monticello died December 7, 1941, aboard the USS Oklahoma. This is by Dick Hogan out of Monticello. The remains of a 19-year-old sailor who died more than four decades ago aboard the USS Oklahoma at Pearl Harbor are being returned to his hometown of Monticello for burial Saturday. "The whole family is happy to have him coming home," Jill Brokaw of Monticello said of her husband's uncle, Seaman First Class Donald A. Stott. "Now we will have some closure and know where he is." Stott joined the Navy at age 17 after his dad agreed and signed the enlistment papers. He had been aboard the Oklahoma for a year and a day when Japanese planes and submarines attacked the harbor in Hawaii on a Sunday morning, December 7, 1941. The Oklahoma capsized and Stott and 428 of his shipmates died. The Day of Infamy attack killed 2,403 U.S. personnel, including 68 civilians, and destroyed or damaged 19 Navy ships, including 8 battleships. Stott's nephew, Tom Brokaw Jr. of Monticello, said his uncle's remains were in Omaha, Nebraska last week awaiting transport. by hearse with a Navy escort to Monticello. Brokaw said he was born 4 years after Stott died, but that Stott had been on his family's minds for years as they hoped for positive identification of his remains. Stott's remains will be laid to rest Saturday in Oakwood Cemetery in Monticello with full military honors provided by the U.S. Navy. The burial will be preceded by an 11 a.m. service at St. Matthew Lutheran Church, 226 North Cedar Street in Monticello, with Pastor David Ramish officiating. Getch Funeral Home of Monticello is assisting the family and Navy. Stott was born February 27, 1922 in Monticello to Wilbur Stott and Dorothy Pearl Gaddy Littlefield Stott. He had two siblings, Raymond Stott and Rose Littlefield Brokaw Schaefer. Those family members have died. His survivors include two nieces, Gertie, spouse Lawrence O'Leary of Herculaneum, Missouri, and Nina, spouse Paul Peterson of Knoxville, Tennessee, and his nephew Tom, spouse Jill Brokaw Jr. of Monticello. Jill Brokaw, 77, said the family could have had Stott's remains buried at a national cemetery, but the family wanted him home in Monticello. The Brokaws realize Stott's return is newsworthy and say all who want to pay respects are welcome, but they want the service and burial to be respectful. "We don't want it to be a media circus," Jill Brokaw said. "We would like to keep it low-key." The Brokaws estimate 70 relatives will attend the service, where a great-great-nephew of Stott's will sing. Also coming will be Larry and John Barons of Monticello, who knew Stott when they were boys. Stott lived with the Barons family for a while during the Depression, Jill Brokaw said. DNA was key. Jill Brokaw said she worked with the Navy and others for more than 10 years to get Stott's remains identified and brought home. She has high praise for the Navy and all it has done to make that happen. Advanced DNA technology was key in the identification and done by comparing the DNA from Stott's oldest living relative to the DNA of his remains, she said. His remains were positively identified 2 years ago. After Pearl Harbor, Navy personnel recovered the remains of those who were killed from December 1941 to June 1944, with remains interred in the Halawa and Nuuana cemeteries in Hawaii. In September 1947, members of the American Graves Registration Services disinterred those remains and transferred them to the Central Identification Laboratory at Schofield Barracks on Oahu. Initially, laboratory staff could confirm the identities of only 35 men from the USS Oklahoma. The unidentified remains were buried in 46 plots at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, known as the Punch Bowl, in Honolulu. In October 1949, a military board classified those who could not be identified, including Stott, as non-recoverable. Given the advances in DNA technology since then, the remains were again exhumed between June and November 2015. Dental and anthropological analysis was used to identify Stott's remains, along with advanced DNA analysis by scientists from the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System. Stott's name is among those recorded on the walls of the missing at the Punch Bowl. A rosette will be placed next to his name to indicate his remains have been accounted for. Hopeful young man. Jill Brokaw said she and her husband have a picture of Stott in their home. "He looks like a hopeful young man," she said. "It makes me sad when I look at it. He never got to live his life." Okay, I'm going to go to the government notes with the headline, Cedar Rapids releases draft plan for community gardens. Also, Trees Forever is offering 4-week tree keepers classes. Following in-person public engagement events and online surveying last fall, a draft of the Community Garden in Parks plan has been completed. The draft plan document is available at cedar-rapids.org. Oh, that's a really long, long website, so I'm not going to try to read that. But it includes an overview of the planning process, concept plans for potential future garden sites, and discussion regarding the management of the garden, including plot fees, maintenance, operations, programming, community partnerships, and funding opportunities. Residents may offer feedback online. Community development staff held an open house for the plan at Nubo City Market earlier this month. Tree Keepers classes start March 28th. Marion-based nonprofit Trees Forever is offering a four-part class series to help people become effective environmental volunteers. The nonprofit's Tree Keepers classes for those in the corridor will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Tuesdays from March 28th to April 18th. The $30 class fee, $15 for students, includes all sessions and class materials, a t-shirt, light snacks, and refreshments. They have night one is going to be at Usher's Ferry Lodge in Cedar Rapids. Night two, April 4th, is also at Usher's Ferry Lodge. Night three, April 11th, will be at Low Park Arts and Environment Center in Marion. Night four, April 18th, will be at Talby Park in Marion. The tree keepers will learn about tree identification and biology, proper planting and maintenance, benefits of trees, urban and community tree issues, volunteer recruitment and engagement. To learn more and register, visit treesforever.org/treekeepers. Johnson Board supports Iowa City Schools preschool program. The Johnson County Board of Supervisors last week unanimously passed a resolution supporting the Iowa City Community School District's preschool program plan. The school district is working on a plan to expand preschool and wraparound services for its students and is asking local municipalities to help fund the new program. Johnson County supports the project and will consider how to best provide financial support as the project moves forward, according to the resolution approved Thursday. The supervisors heard a presentation from the district early last month. District officials said the program will cost between $4.4 million and $5.5 million, depending on enrollment. Local municipalities would be responsible for covering $1.7 million, which would be divided up depending on the projected number of students from each area. The municipalities listed, in addition to the county, include North Liberty, Coralville, Iowa City, Hills, and University Heights. Johnson County would be responsible for the number of students living in unincorporated areas of the county. The Iowa City Council will be discussing the preschool program at its work session Tuesday. Johnson supervisors likely to increase county workers' wages. The Johnson County Board of Supervisors discussed an additional wage increase for county employees and elected officials in the fiscal 2024 budget. During last week's work session, Supervisor Lisa Green Douglas said county wages have not kept up with the high inflation rate. She suggested a 4% wage increase, which the other supervisors agreed with. "It's important that we value our people, Supervisor V. Vixmer Ores said. Supervisor Roysan Porter added that the county needs to increase wages if it wants to remain competitive when recruiting and retaining employees. The supervisors last month first discussed wages for fiscal 2024, which starts July 1st. It was mentioned county employees would get an adjustment of 2.5%. Three of the five supervisors supported the following salary increases for elected officials of 2.5% for the county attorney, 1.875% for the sheriff, and 1.5625% for the supervisors, auditor, recorder, and treasurer. The board is expected to vote on two resolutions to increase the wages from the initial recommendation, one for employees and another for elected officials. Last week's discussion was during a work session, so no formal action was taken. Iowa City Police Review Board to host hosting forum. Iowa City's Community Police Review Board will host its annual public forum next month. The community forum is a way for the board to hear views on the Iowa City Police Department's policies and procedures. The forum will be at 5:30 p.m. April 20th in the Iowa City Public Library's Meeting Room A. The community is invited to submit questions and comments ahead of the event. Questions and comments need to be submitted by April 10th and can be emailed to cprb@iowacity.org or mailed to City Hall, 410 East Washington Street. Individuals should include their full name and address since the submissions are public, the city said in a news release. The board will try to address all questions and comments received. A replay of the forum will be available for viewing on the City Channel 4 website. Our next story is entitled, "He's Going to Die, Care Facility Fined $10,000 After Resident's Death." Man with disability died after staff at Iowa facility ignored complaints of pain. It's by Clark Kaufman. A Western Iowa care facility for people with disabilities has been fined $10,000 for contributing to the death of a resident. Larry Overturf, 65, had a moderate intellectual disability and had lived at Courage Homes, a 45-bed care facility in Sioux City, for 3 years before his death in December. State inspection records indicate Overturf began refusing meals on November 26 and complained repeatedly of stomach pain over the next 4 days. A supervisor later told state inspectors that in addition to Overturf's complaints of stomach pain, his color looked off and he was activating his call light about every 30 seconds to summon help, which was something he had never done before. The supervisor told inspectors she grew upset with the nursing staff over their perceived lack of response to the situation and eventually told two registered nurses, "He's going to die before you finally decide to help him." In speaking to inspectors, one of the two nurses acknowledged she spoke to Overturf the evening of November 30th, which was the night before he died. She allegedly stated Overturf was weeping while complaining of pain and acknowledged she was aware he had been complaining of stomach pain for almost a week and that she did not check his vital signs. According to inspectors, on the night of November 30th, Overturf's use of his call light prompted a worker to move him out of his room and into a living room area where he could lie on a couch with the call light out of reach. The worker later told inspectors Overturf moaned loudly all night and appeared to be in a lot of pain. Overturf was found unresponsive early the next morning and was taken to a hospital where he died that afternoon. The cause of death was a twisted or strangulated bowel, according to state records. The Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals investigated and, citing Overturf's death, concluded the home had placed residents in immediate jeopardy by failing to respond to residents' medical needs. The agency fined the home $10,000. Courage Homes is a state-licensed intermediate care facility for individuals with intellectual disabilities and is managed by Mid-Step Services. Overturf grew up in Thornton and over the years had resided at the Eagle Grove Group Home, Opportunity Village in Clear Lake, and the Heritage Care and Rehabilitation Center in Mason City. He participated in the Special Olympics, enjoyed church, and was a fan of the Minnesota Vikings and Minnesota Twins. His sister, Deborah McGlardy of Sioux City, said her brother and their mother each moved from Mason City to Sioux City in 2019 so the family could see more of each other. "It was important for us to be close to him, and it was important for him too," she said. "He had a very caring family who loved him very much." Our next headline is Iowa schools add naloxone to medical emergency kits. Cedar Rapids among districts stocking Narcan to reverse opioid overdoses after state legislature passed new law. This is by Grace King out of Cedar Rapids. An Iowa law passed last year allows schools to stock and administer the life-saving medication naloxone to combat the effects of an opioid overdose. Since then, many Iowa schools have adopted policies and procedures to add naloxone, brand name Narcan, to their toolkit, said Sandy Byard, Cedar Rapids School's Health Services Coordinator. "Absolutely, we want to have it to help students, staff, or family members who have a medical emergency in our schools," Byard said. Naloxone is a drug approved by the Food and Drug Administration that quickly reverses an overdose by blocking the effects of opioids. It can restore normal breathing within 2 to 3 minutes in a person whose breathing has slowed or stopped because of an opioid overdose. Last May, the Iowa legislature passed a new law, House File 2573, allowing school districts to receive prescriptions for Narcan and creating a fund to cover the cost. The law also established an opioid antagonist medication fund to ensure first responders have access to naloxone and other potentially life-saving medications to reverse opioid overdoses. In 2021, Iowa saw 479 fatal opioid overdoses, a 12% increase from the previous year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A suspected overdose can look like unresponsiveness with slow or shallow breathing, drowsiness and confusion, nausea, vomiting, or a slow heartbeat. 50 school nurses and personnel have been trained in Cedar Rapids schools to administer naloxone, at least one person in every building. Narcan is included in an emergency response kit at each school. Byard compared naloxone to water. If administered to someone experiencing an opioid overdose, it will reverse the effects. Otherwise, it's completely harmless, she said. To have it out of the hospital setting and out to the public where anybody can have it, that's truly amazing, Byard said. Iowa City and Des Moines schools also have been stocking Narcan last year. Byard said Cedar Rapids schools' emergency response teams can get called several times a week in an individual school. In addition to naloxone, Cedar Rapids schools' emergency response kits include automated external defibrillators and epinephrine, among other items. The Cedar Rapids Community School District also is working toward becoming Project ATOM certified by the end of the school year. Project ATOM is a national organization that helps schools and communities to establish a plan to respond to sudden cardiac arrest. This includes making automated external defibrillators readily available. The portable electronic devices automatically diagnose potentially life-threatening heart rhythms and decide whether a shock is needed. If necessary, they then deliver a shock to restore a normal heart rhythm. Byard said the coronavirus pandemic helped bring to light the important role school nurses play in education. Nurses were relied on heavily to manage quarantine and isolation procedures if there was a COVID-19 exposure, she said. School nurses are the only medical experts in a school, Byard said. We are writing health plans for students with seizure disorders, diabetes, or other health complications, and making sure everyone knows the protocols. We provide a lot of primary care services, such as getting kids free glasses, setting up medical appointments, and finding transportation. We're working with community providers to reduce health-related barriers to learning. Okay, we now will turn to the opinion section. We just have one community letter. It's entitled LGBTQ+ Bills in Legislature, A Sign of What's to Come. I am heartbroken to see Iowa lawmakers attempt to block medically necessary and potentially life-saving gender-affirming care for vulnerable children. My husband and I sought and received such care for our minor child, and we intend to fight for the rights of other parents to do the same. Was the gender-affirming surgery our child received life-saving in the same way as the surgery that removed their inflamed appendix when they were 12? Yes, it was. Did the doctors who pledged to first do no harm keep at the forefront what was best for our child and their future in both cases? Yes, they did. Do Iowans truly want their legislators to make decisions about their health care? No, I believe they don't. My late father was a lifelong Republican and a physician trained at the University of Iowa, and he would have been outraged to see this cruel assault not only on the grandchild he loved, but also on the profession to which he dedicated his professional life. He would also be appalled by the hypocrisy of lawmakers who claim to support parental rights but then choose which parents get to enjoy them. Republican legislators and Governor Kim Reynolds seem determined to trample the rights of LGBTQ+ folks. The current onslaught of senseless bills is a harbinger of what could come, and for me, silence is not an option. Wake up, Iowans, and get off the sidelines, because the next freedom they take away could be yours. And that was from Karen Butler out of Iowa City. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Connie Sue Lowe, 52, of Iowa City, formerly of Tama, passed away Friday, March 17, 2023, at her home in Iowa City due to a sudden illness. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 22nd, at Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama with Pastor Paul Rendell officiating. Interment will follow at Oak Hill Cemetery in Tama. Visitation will be held prior to the service from 10 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 22nd, at the funeral home. Connie was born November 14, 1970, in Marshalltown, the daughter of Marvin and Mary Jean Novotny Lowe. Connie graduated from South Tama High School in 1989. After high school, she worked at the Tama Paper Board before entering college. Connie graduated from the University of Iowa, majoring in journalism. From there, she enrolled in Kirkwood Community College and graduated with a paralegal degree. After college, Connie worked as a paralegal in Rock Island, Illinois, Cedar Rapids, and Amana. She was an avid animal lover, taking a special interest in rescuing and caring for neglected animals. Connie loved to garden, read, and do home improvement jobs at her home in Iowa City, at her rental house, and for her mother. She also loved playing board games and putting together puzzles with her mother. Connie took great pride in being the president of her condo association where she resided in Iowa City. Survivors include her mother, Mary Jean Lowe of Tama, her pet cats, Pebbles and Coley, and several uncles, aunts, and cousins. She was preceded in death by her father, Marvin Lowe, on February 14, 2007, and her grandparents. A memorial fund will be established. Trevor L. Hopkins, 47, of Iowa City, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died suddenly at his home Friday, March 17th. A time for family and friends to gather will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 22nd, at Gay and Seha Funeral and Cremation Service, concluding with some words from family and friends, beginning at 6:30 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in his memory to the Iowa City Bike Library. A complete obituary will appear in Tuesday's edition. To share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit Gay and Seha Funeral and Cremation Service website. Clarissa Cookie Maker died March 16th, received her wings after a battle with liver disease March 16th. She was from Cedar Rapids. She was the second oldest of nine children. Her dream as a child was to grow up to be a good mom to four kids. She achieved her dream and then some. She parented more than just her biological kids. She was a parent to anyone who needed one. Her heart was huge. She always had enough love for more. When you spoke to her, you felt as if you were the only person that mattered to her. She listened so intently, you could feel her love for you. She married Terry Maker in August of 1985 and gained two more children. She was blessed with many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and friends. Per Clarissa's wishes, she will not have funeral services. She had a going-away party disguised as a birthday party last September and said it was the best gift she ever received. She asked that we thank everyone who was able to attend. Her passing leaves a hole in many lives, but she is in heaven dancing and singing, keeping the party going until we join her again. Betty Jane Remke Thuma of Tipton, 94, entered eternity on Thursday, March 16th, while at Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton. Fry Funeral Home will host a visitation from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, March 21st. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 22nd, at the Trinity Lutheran Church in Tipton, followed by a luncheon. After the luncheon, Betty will be laid to rest at the Stanwood Cemetery. Cards and memorials may be mailed to 308 Mulberry Street, Tipton, Iowa, 52772. You are invited to read Betty's full obituary and share online condolences at fryfuneralhome.com. Francis James Jim Golly, 91, of Marion, passed away peacefully at his home on Friday, March 17th. He battled with several health issues, but mainly kidney disease. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Jim was born on June 2, 1931, to John and Honora Ann Brislon Golly in Hopkinton. They later moved to Prairieburg. He proudly served in the U.S. Navy from 1948 to 1953. During that time, he was commissioned to a troop transfer ship as a teletype operator and then transferred to the island of Guam as a Seabee. When Jim returned to the States, he had many different jobs, from farming, building TV and communication towers, factory supervisor, to pizza delivery. During his retirement years, he worked at a local subway, and at the age of 90, he retired once more. He enjoyed fishing, doing yard work and bowling, his latest hobby, putting puzzles together. He loved his family and cherished the time spent with them. Jim was preceded in death by his parents and his siblings, Arlene Rutan, Trudy Foster, and Robert Bob Golly. He is survived by his brother, William Bill Golly, children Mike, spouse Vaughn Golly, Deb Schropp, Dennis, spouse Jackie Golly, Dave, spouse Carol Golly, Tim, spouse Robin Golly, and Linda Tally Dye. 10 grandchildren, 30 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren. The family would like to thank Gentiva Hospice and DaVita Dialysis for the love and care given to Jim. Condolences for the family may be left at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Leona Lee Lloyd, 85, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Saturday, March 18th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m., Monday, March 20th, at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, located at 2121 Bowling Street, Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, March 21st, at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church, Hiawatha. Burial will follow in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Leona was born August 11, 1937, in Conroy, the daughter of Elmer and Matilda Hunzelman Martinson. She graduated from Conroy High School, class of 1955. She worked at Amana Refrigeration, where she met her husband Luke. Leona was united in marriage to Luke Lloyd on December 6, 1969, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. She worked at Aegon Transamerica for many years until her retirement in 2003. She enjoyed tending to her garden and flowers, watching and feeding birds, traveling, and most of all, spending time with her family, especially the grandchildren. Leona is survived by her husband Luke, her children Laura, spouse Andy Rogers, Lloyd Rogers, and Mike, spouse Katia Lloyd, 5 grandchildren, Clayton, Sela, Reagan, Caleb, and Michael, her brother Merlin Martinson, her sister-in-law Nancy Martinson, as well as many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, her siblings Irvin, spouse Marcella Martinson, Milford Martinson, Norma, spouse Noel Seams, and Joyce, spouse Dwight Mum, sisters-in-law Irene Seams, Sylvia Martinson, and Edith Martinson, and sister Anna Marie in infancy. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at broshchapel.com. Okay, we're going to turn to sports. Big headline just says sweet. Hawkeyes earn cleansing victory over Georgia to reach the Sweet 16. This is by Jeff Linder out of Iowa City. Euphoria was absent in the winning locker room, or at the very least, muted. There wasn't a huge party or celebration, Caitlin Clark said. The Sweet 16 isn't the goal. This was the first weekend. Now it's on to the second weekend, and hopefully there's a third. The best word for third-ranked Iowa's 74-66 NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament second-round win over Georgia on Sunday at a sold-out Carver Hawkeye Arena? Cleansing. The Hawkeyes, whose record is 28-6, washed away both the sting and the stink from last year's shocking second-round loss to Creighton, holding Georgia scoreless in the final 2 minutes 15 seconds after the Bulldogs, whose record is 22-12, got within 68-66. Iowa will face number 13 Duke or number 21 Colorado in a regional semifinal Friday at Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle. The Blue Devils, whose record is 27-6, and the Buffaloes, whose record is 25-8, collide at 8 p.m. Iowa time tonight. It will be Iowa's ninth Sweet 16 appearance overall, its fourth since 2015. Monica Cisnano and McKenna Warnock were winners in their final Carver appearance. Both shed a tear or two as they walked off the home court for the final time. "I don't show much emotion," Warnock said. "Monica started it first. It's her fault." Cisnano said, "I was hugging assistant coach Jan Jensen, and I saw my family in the crowd. I'm just so appreciative of everything. If I've given back a quarter of what this place has given me, I've done my job." Clark, likely to be named the National Player of the Year, the Associated Press releases its choice March 30th, posted 22 points and 12 assists and had a hand in 33 of Iowa's final 35 points, whether by scoring or distributing. "I really didn't want this team to lose," she said. "This is really special. The crowd responds when I throw my arms in the air." For 38 minutes, Sunday's game was eerily similar to the one that marked Iowa's demise last year. Georgia was right on Iowa's heels at 68-66 when Audrey Warren nailed a three-pointer with 2 minutes 15 seconds left. Clark missed a short jumper, then got another chance on the next possession and banked it home. The Bulldogs, meanwhile, turned it over on 3 straight possessions. "We had an opportunity and couldn't capitalize on it," Georgia's Javon Nicholson said. "It got snippy at the end. with Iowa still in front, 70-66 in the final seconds, Marshall absorbed a hard foul, an intentional foul. Clark took the two free throws and made both. Iowa got possession, and the Bulldogs committed another intentional foul. Clark converted two more free throws for the final margin. The last 2 minutes weren't indicative of the game, said Georgia coach Katie Abramson Henderson, a Cedar Rapids native and Iowa alum. There were two good teams on the floor today, and one of them was Georgia. All five of Iowa's starters played 37 minutes or more, with Clark on the floor for the full 40. Key post reserve Hannah Stolke turned an ankle, literally, with 3 minutes left in practice Saturday, Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. She did treatments until late last night, and I thought she would be able to go, but in the first warm-up, I knew it was going to be tough for her. Molly Davis got tangled up with a Georgia player and was shaken up late in the first quarter. Her playing time was limited the rest of the way. Iowa made 7 of its first 9 three-point attempts, with Warnock's long shot giving the Hawkeyes their largest lead of the day, 31-21, with 7 minutes and 28 seconds left in the second quarter. But Georgia rallied quickly and took a 35-34 lead late in the second quarter. Iowa led 41-40 at halftime. The Bulldogs' last time in front was 52-51, then Cisnano converted inside. Gabby Marshall hit a three-pointer, and Warnock scored from the baseline to push Iowa in front 58-52. Cisnano's bucket made it 64-56, then the Hawkeyes weathered one final Georgia push. I'm thrilled, Bluter said. Georgia is an excellent basketball team. We had to play very, very well to get this victory. Cisnano added 20 points and 9 rebounds for the Hawkeyes. Marshall continued her late-season surge with 15, and Warnock tallied 14 points and 8 boards. With us, who are you going to guard? Clark said. Who are you going to leave open? Diamond Battles led Georgia with 21 points. Nicholson and Brittany Smith added 12 apiece. Okay, we've got an article here on college wrestling. As real as it gets, second place. Iowa's 141-pounder finishes runner-up in only season with Hawks by K.J. Pilcher out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Real Woods came to University of Iowa with his sights set on a national title. In one season with the Hawkeyes, the graduate from Stanford and returning All-American posted his best college finish. Woods suffered a 6-4 defeat to Northern Colorado's Andrew Alarez in the 140-pound final and placed second at the NCAA Division I Wrestling Championships on Saturday night at BOK Center. He extended Iowa's streak of at least one national finalist to 33 straight years. Top-seeded Woods said the immediate takeaways were negative, including frustration and heartbreak, but there was solace in moving one step closer to his gold medal dream. I'm definitely proud of myself, Woods said. I never let that fly. I'm never disappointed in myself. Interestingly enough, even after this outcome, I'm not disappointed in myself. I'm simply angry. The result and corresponding response are indicative of the daily challenges everyone faces. Woods recognizes that and presses on. It hurts, Woods said. Like I said, I'm not disappointed in myself. I'm very proud of myself. I'm ready to move forward, and that's what life's about. That's what's so beautiful about this sport. This is the kind of stuff you're going to deal with in life. Through any hardship, you're going to deal with this pain and the fact that you need to move forward and continue to move on and grow. That's just life. Woods is wired exactly that way and will be a strong example to follow for his Hawkeye teammates. We have to come back strong, Iowa coach Tom Brand said. We will. We have character. I believe that. You've got to build. Real Woods will move on because of his character, who he is, and his roots, his family, people who have coached him, and that's it. After a scoreless first, Woods took a 2-0 lead with two near falls off a tilt. Just 8 seconds later, as Alarez made it to his feet, they got tangled up in a scramble that resulted in a reversal, 4-point near fall, and a 6-4 advantage that would hold for Northern Colorado's first NCAA title. I wanted it so bad I put myself in an exposed position and it bit me in the butt, Woods said. I guess it is what it is. Woods, whose record is 20-1, improved on his sixth-place finish a year ago. Attention shifts to the future and growing as a wrestler to take that one last step. I feel like I'm poised, calm, and composed, but staying focused from moment to moment in a match, Woods said. Small mistakes like that, it's crazy, can change a whole result. Iowa had 6 All-Americans, including 4th-place heavyweight Tony Cassiope and 5th-place duo Nelson Brands at 174 and 197-pounder Jacob Warner. Max Murin at 149 and Spencer Lee at 125 were sixth. Iowa has had at least five All-Americans in 10 straight seasons. It was the 15th time Iowa had five or more All-Americans in 17 seasons under Tom Brands. Woods, Cassiope, and Brands could return for next season, as well as 184-pound national qualifier Abe Assad, who was a National Wrestling Coaches Association All-American in 2020. The other thing that has to be said is you have to give celebration status to the guys that earned it, Brands said. We had six All-Americans, so it's not sucking your thumb walking out there. Iowa also has NCAA qualifiers Drake Ayala at 125, Brody Teske at 133, Kobe Siebrecht at 157, and 165-pounder Patrick Kennedy, who was the sixth seed this year, expected back. Mix in some incoming talent with the 48 points returning from this season, and the Hawkeyes could reload after their 48th NCAA team trophy and 7th national runner-up team finish. I'm excited, Woods said. We have an incredible team. It's led by the best coaches in the world, so I'm really excited about the future. The Hawkeyes will have to replace lineup stalwarts Lee, Murin, and Warner, who helped Iowa win the 2021 NCAA team title and garnered 12 combined All-American honors. We've got some guys coming back that we have to have them thinking the right way, right away, walking out of this building, Tom Brand said. And that's it in a nutshell. Okay, and one final sports story. Let's do an NCAA men's tournament roundup. Michigan State makes the Sweet 16 out of the Associated Press. Tyson Walker scored 23 points and number 7 seed Michigan State beat 2nd seeded Marquette 69-60 in the second round of the NCAA tournament on Sunday in Columbus, Ohio, sending coach Tom Izzo's squad back to the Sweet 16 for the first time in 4 years. Joey Hauser, a Marquette transfer, had 14 points and A.J. Huggard had 13 as Michigan State, whose record is 21-12, took over in the last 3 minutes. The Spartans advanced to play third-seeded Kansas State in the East Region semifinals on Thursday at New York's Madison Square Garden. Izzo, the 68-year-old Hall of Fame coach, reached his 15th regional semifinal and won his record 16th March Madness game with a lower-seeded team, one more than Syracuse's Jim Boeheim, who retired after this season. Olivier Maxence Prosper led Marquette 29-7 with 16 points, and Cam Jones had 14 points, including 3 three-pointers for the Big East champions. Kansas State 75, Kentucky 69. Marquis Noel scored 23 of his 27 points after halftime, and Kansas State overcame a horrid start from outside by hitting a couple of clutch three-pointers in Greensboro, North Carolina. KSU coach Jerome Tang has gone from having just 2 players on the roster to having a matching number of NCAA wins, sending the Wildcats, whose record is 25-9, to their first Sweet 16 since 2018. "Dudes," Tang said. "We got dudes. That's what it takes. I mean, people get all caught up in the coaching and all of that stuff. It's dudes." Xavier 84, Pittsburgh 73. Sean Miller has unselfish Xavier back in the Sweet 16. Jack Nunes scored 18 points. Adam Kunkel added 15 on 5 first-half three-pointers. And number 3 seed Xavier beat 11th-seeded Pittsburgh 84-73 on Sunday in Greensboro, North Carolina, to advance to the NCAA tournament's 2nd week for the first time since 2017. Colby Jones had 10 points, 14 rebounds, and 7 assists, and Soli Bohm and Jerome Hunter each chipped in with 14 points as all 5 Xavier starters scored in double digits. Xavier entered the game leading the country in assists per game, 19.2, and had 17 on 19 baskets in the first half to build a 48-34 lead at the break. The Musketeers finished with 22 assists. Xavier's record is 27-9, moves on to play number 2 seed Texas on Friday in the Midwest Region semifinals in Kansas City, Missouri. UConn 70, St. Mary's 55. Adama Sanogo scored 24 points and Jordan Hawkins delivered from the 3-point line in the second half as UConn pulled away Sunday in Albany, New York, with a win that put the Huskies in the Sweet 16 for the first time in 9 years. Number 4 seed UConn, whose record is 27-8, advanced to the West Regional in Las Vegas on Thursday. Next up is 8th seeded Arkansas, which knocked off number 1 seed Kansas. Sonogo followed up his 28-point game in the Huskies' NCAA tourney opener against Iona with another powerful and efficient performance in the paint. The 245-pound junior was 11-for-16 from the floor and grabbed 8 rebounds, dominating a big man matchup with Mitchell Saxon, 6 points, 3 rebounds, and 4 fouls. St. Mary's, whose record is 27-8, of the West Coast Conference, failed to get out of the first weekend of the tournament for the second straight season as a number 5 seed. Aiden Mahaney and Logan Johnson each scored 9 for the Gales, who played the final 25 minutes without third leading scorer Alex Dukas. The senior left with an apparent back injury. UConn used a 14-2 spurt, highlighted by a 3 from Hawkins, with 11 minutes 28 seconds left in the second half to go up 51-40. Okay, we're going to turn to the community section and the Eastern Iowa Briefs out of Iowa City. Earth Expo coming to Robert A. Lee Rec Center on April 2nd. Earth Expo will be held from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. April 2nd at the Robert A. Lee Recreation Center, 220 South Gilbert Street. This family-friendly event features nearly a dozen local organizations coming together for environmentally fun activities and booths. These organizations will be showcasing opportunities to learn about the environment and sustainable actions both children and adults can practice. Activities include making a tree cookie necklace, plant care lessons, animal tracking lessons, and more. Exhibitors include American Resiliency, Burr Oak Land Trust, Good Neighbor Iowa, the Sierra Club, Table to Table, Trees Forever, and the University of Iowa Flood Center. The event is a collaboration between Green Iowa AmeriCorps, the Corridor Community Action Network, Iowa City Parks and Recreation, and Iowa City Climate Action and Outreach. Earth Expo is free, but RSVPs are encouraged on the Expo's Facebook event. Cedar Rapids, Nubo City Market to hold two-day Entrepreneur Summit. Nubo City Market welcomes the community to take part in a two-day business development summit and pitch competition, resulting in one lucky entrepreneur winning a space at the market rent-free for a year, paid for by Lynn Area Credit Union. The event will be held Friday and Saturday. Friday will feature an entrepreneurial summit from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., providing networking and business development resources and seminars for community members thinking about starting a business, as well as the emerging entrepreneur finalists. Topics ranging from business banking to identifying growth milestones, among several others, will be discussed. Friday also will include a marketing power hour, which consists of a panel of marketing professionals available to lend their expertise on the best ways to effectively market a new business. Each of the seminar-style breakout sessions will include presentations by industry experts in the fields of law, human resources, banking, finance, and more. A full list of sessions and facilitators can be found on the market's website. On Saturday, shoppers will vote with their dollars for their favorite entrepreneur at the Emerging Entrepreneur Finalist Guest Vendor Market from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. At the end of the day, a panel of judges will evaluate the finalists on several categories, such as the day's sales, merchandising, and their business plan. The entrepreneur with the most votes will win the title of Lynn Area Credit Union Emerging Entrepreneur of the Year and a rent-free space at Nubo City Market. The winner will be announced by 6 p.m. For more information, visit nubocitymarket.org/emerging-entrepreneur-summit. Out of Des Moines, the State Historical Society of Iowa Book Club kicks off March 30th. The State Historical Society of Iowa's Book Club kicks off this month with a new lineup of entertaining and thought-provoking books and authors. The Iowa History Book Club will feature The Good Country, A History of the American Midwest, 1800 to 1900, by John Locke at 7 p.m. March 30th to wrap up Iowa History Month. Each discussion will be led by Andrew Klump, editor of The Annals of Iowa, the quarterly journal published by the State Historical Society of Iowa, a division of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. The program has grown each of the two previous years as our authors continue to share thought-provoking insights about our state's past, Glump said. We're expecting even more people to join us this year, so I encourage all who have an interest in the history of Iowa to sign up right away. All the programs will be hosted online and recorded via Zoom, then posted afterward at iowaculture.gov. Registration is free but required for each event. Questions may be submitted with the online registration form or during the event itself, and participants are encouraged but not required to read the book before the meeting. All the books can be purchased online or borrowed from most libraries. The 2023 Iowa History Book Club schedule follows. March 30th, 7 p.m., The Good Country, A History of the American Midwest, 1800 to 1900 by John Locke, hosted by Andrew Klump and John Locke. May 11th at 7 p.m., Saved by Schindler, The Life of Selina Carp-Benez by William B. Friedrichs, hosted by Andrew Klump and William B. Friedrichs. September 7th at 7 p.m., A Woman of Adventure, The Life and Times of First Lady Lou Henry Hoover by Annette Dunlap, hosted by Andrew Klump and Annette Dunlap. November 30th, 7 p.m., Women Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, 1870 to 1920 by Sarah Egge, hosted by Andrew Klump and Sarah Egge. For more information or to register, visit iowaculture.gov. Our last article here is entitled Poll, 62% Oppose Private School Scholarships Law by Stephen Gruber Miller and Samantha Hernandez from the Des Moines Register. Iowans oppose Governor Kim Reynolds' signature school choice law, which allows families to use taxpayer money to pay for private schools by nearly a 2-to-1 margin, according to a new Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll. More than 6 in 10 Iowans, 62%, oppose the law. The program will allow every Iowa family to receive about $7,600 annually per student in an education savings account to pay private school costs such as tuition and fees. Just over a third of Iowans favor the policy at 34%. Another 4% are not sure. The poll of 805 Iowa adults was conducted March 5th through 8th by Selzer & Company. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Reynolds' plan to use taxpayer money to pay for students' private school faces majority opposition from a host of groups, Democrats and Republicans, men and women, urban and rural dwellers, as well as Iowans with children under 18. This year was Reynolds' third attempt to pass some version of school choice legislation and her most expansive proposal. It also generated the greatest opposition among Iowans compared with previous school choice proposals tested in earlier Iowa polls. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.